The University Tower chimes, bringing another session of Ask the Professor, the show on which you match wits with University of Detroit Mercy professors in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. I'm your host, Matt Mayo, and let me introduce to you our panel for today. All the panels have rearranged, so who knows who's going first? But this time, it's Dan Maggio.
Oh, wow.
Hey. Dan.
I mean, you could also consider it last and then building up to first, but I'll take first. I'm at.
The first shall be last, Dan, and the last shall be first.
Yes, namaste.
What's been going on lately, Dano?
Not much, just busy.
I think that I missed you today.
I was in the office. I was chatting and catching up with Jane. And I think you were busy with chairman duties, chatting with Liz, maybe. Who was in Liz's office now?
That's Mara.
Oh, yes. I think you were just chatting in there. I thought I heard you. And then I visited with Jane, and then I went over into the bookstore. You know, I noticed that they carved out a place for a credit union in the side of the...
Yeah.
What was in there before?
There was nothing there. Dan, are you ready for this?
No, because I'm really curious, like all my years there, what was in there?
I don't think there was anything there. They knocked that wall down to build that. Yes. They were supposed to open the Monday after spring break 2020.
Well, and then so much for that. I was hoping for some secret chemistry lab or something like that. That would have been neater.
That would have been nice. But
Matt, we could start that rumor.
We could. Absolutely.
They used to have one in the old days in, I think, that same space.
No, that was in the Student Union building.
Union building. Next
in
to
the lobby.
Across from the bookstore.
Now it's on the facing wall towards the fountain on the outside part of the new Student Union. But it's old, if that makes any sense. Someone who definitely is in Liz Roberts Kirchhoff's old office, but we call it Mara's office now. It's Mara Livesey.
Hello. It's now my office.
And how are your kitties doing today?
Oh, they're doing great. They really love it on Thursdays when I work from home the entire day.
Do they actually give you some sort of outward like understanding of the fact they know that you're going to be there that day?
I don't think they know that I'm here on Thursdays, but on Thursdays, you know, they normally would just like be doing their own thing, but on Thursdays to make a special effort to be with me basically all day.
Oh, that's nice.
Don't be fooled. They're cats. Yes.
I don't know what that means.
There's an ulterior motive, I'm sure.
It means when they snuggle up with you, it's because they're secretly plotting to kill you.
Yes. They're tenderizing you. Tenderizing. Yes.
Exactly.
That's all right.
Exactly.
It's all right. I can accept that.
And someone who knows a lot about her cats plotting to kill her, it's Beth Oldjar.
Indeed. They have not yet succeeded, however.
Do they ever have their little paws sort of together, like evil plans like that?
No, not really. I mean, when Mia's having an evil plan, she just sticks her claws in you. So, you know.
Well, that gets the point across quite quickly.
Yes. Or the furniture or whatever. You know, her scratching post. She's not particular.
Right, right. Exactly. Whatever's in front of her at that
Everything
moment.
Everything
right?
is a scratching post. Yeah.
Oh, my. Professor Stephen Manning is here with us, too. What's going on, Stephen?
I think I just heard our family pet bark, meaning he wants something.
Uh-huh. I think I heard that, too.
He has his cone off, though. I'm so happy for him.
Yes, he got the cone off. Did you hear that?
Yes.
Yes. So I better... she's going to attend to him. Okay.
Somebody will.
Yeah, so he's sort of back to normal after he was in on... Tuesday, I think, and he's kind of back normal. We have to revise his whole diet, apparently. This condition was brought on by his, and this is particular with this breed, these Arctic animals, they don't absorb the zinc that they take in.
Huh.
So we have to make sure that the zinc he takes in stays in his body, is absorbed in his body. And what that typically means is raw food, raw meat, and raw chicken.
So you're bringing in more whale blubber, right, Stephen?
Yeah, that would be great. Whale blubber, anything, but it's got to be raw because in the raw form, it absorbs into the body more. And we supplements, and we have to seek out now and most vets, including ours, admittedly, has no idea what this condition is, has never seen it before.
Sure.
So we're looking for a specialist in this breed of dog that can help us. How much raw chicken do we actually give him, right? Because the other part of this is zinc is toxic in too much.
I see, large doses. So,
you know, you got to figure out exactly how much you got to give him.
Well, I'm relieved to hear it's not the neighbors that you're feeding him.
Yes, not the neighbors. So that's been our life recently.
Of course.
Aye, aye, aye.
Fresh back from taking care of your pooch is Heather Hill.
Hey, what's up?
What was the issue? We have to know.
Whale blubber.
What? He just had to go out.
Oh, nature was
and
calling.
Do his business.
He went out with a harpoon.
Yeah. Well, he also chased a squirrel for a minute. So.
Oh, fun. Great fun.
Yes, it is fun.
You have an enclosed backyard.
We do. Now we do. Yes.
We do.
Yes.
So. Nice.
He seems much happier since he started eating raw meat.
That's what Stephen was telling us about the legend of the zinc.
We're, of course, resigned to eating grilled cheese sandwiches 5 nights a week.
Right, exactly.
Eating a lot better than we are.
Government surplus cheese at that, right?
And
true of many pet owners.
A variety of tinned foods. Here he is now.
Jim Tubbs is also here with us today.
I was going to suggest there's always spam.
I'll have tasty. Your spam, dear.
I can't tell you the last time that I've had it, but I know I've had it.
It's actually really delicious.
Yeah.
It is.
Can't help but think of it when you're at your favorite grocery concern and you see the sign hanging from the ceiling, canned meat. I'm like, I know what's in that section.
That's right.
Oh, my dad used to love that Underwood deviled ham. He still does.
Oh, yeah.
And he likes spam too.
Ham shoulder.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And that ham shoulder is Dave Chow, our last panelist to be introduced for today.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
So. Excellent. Glad to have you, ham shoulder.
I was going to say, and he's a ham shoulder, apparently.
It's a good one. It still works. It still rotates.
Folks, this is a program. You can send us questions regarding anything. If you stump the panel, you win a prize. You can send us questions in a number of ways. You can email us at atp@udmercy.edu. Find us on Facebook or Instagram or listen on your favorite smart speaker by asking it to play Ask the Professor at University of Detroit Mercy. It's been a while, but we have been favored with a nice, solid, chunky, delicious set of questions by our old friend and longtime question sender, Kimberly Richards of Van Nuys, California. And I think these are kind of all over the map. Kimberly always does a fantastic job of giving us background on the correct responses to these. So let's see what we can do with them. What was the first human-made object that could break the sound barrier?
A whip?
Yeah, a whip is what it says here, the bull whip in particular. The tip of the whip breaks the sound barrier and causes a sharp crack, which is literally a sonic boom. The sound barrier is a popular term for the sudden increase in aerodynamic drag and other effects experienced by aircraft and other objects when they approach supersonic speed. When aircraft first began to reach close to supersonic speed, these effects were seen as constituting a barrier, making supersonic speed very difficult or, dun, 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 possibly impossible. Very cool. Let's see. In dry air at 68 degrees Fahrenheit, the sound barrier is reached when an object moves 767 miles per hour. That is fast.
Like when you call Mara's name out when you volunteer her for something.
Yeah, exactly.
That spin move was still amazing. That was just unreal.
Professors, which state in the Great Union that we have here passed the first law for a Labor Day?
Well, it's one out of 50 chance.
Oregon.
It was Oregon was number one, baby.
Look at that.
Yeah. Nice.
That physician-assisted suicide, right? And legalizing all drugs.
Wait a second. Mara's response is typical.
Yeah.
What year was it?
Oh.
after 1859, because that's when Oregon was admitted to the Union.
That's a good start.
You affect your world positively. Yes, that was 1887, which is definitely after 1859. By 1894, we had reached about 50% participation by the states in the Union. So just about 7 years later, you were good to go. It says here, just real quick, right after Oregon, almost exactly after Oregon, same year, but Oregon was first, Colorado, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey.
It was the hip thing to do.
Well, the weather's good in Oregon at Labor Day, typically.
That's always a good thing.
If it wasn't raining, you want a holiday.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking pretty strongly here in a Jim Tubbs kind of direction, because I bet that he has floated down the question this time, which is, what's the longest river in Europe?
Danube?
Tagus?
Elbe?
Nope.
Danube is pretty long. Let me think.
Says this river is 2,300 miles long. That is a long river.
Volga.
Ah, there we go. It's the Volga. The Volga in Russia. Super, utterly, technically Europe. But it is the longest river in Russia and the longest river in Europe. Yes.
Stalingrad was on the Volga.
The Volga. Also, the largest reservoir in the world is associated with the Volga. I can tell you where we don't have the world's largest reservoir anymore, and that's at the Hoover Dam, since half of the water is gone.
Shriveling up.
And I used to joke when I first started teaching that I was scared to death that somehow reps or senators from the Southwest were going to become super powerful and just build a pipeline from Lake Michigan all the way down
to and drain us silly.
And now I feel like, oh my gosh, we're closer than ever before.
The water wars are coming.
Mm-hmm. What U.S. city has the most restaurants per capita, at least 2019 pre-COVID?
New York City.
Royal Oak.
Chicago.
None of these that you have said.
Oh. New Orleans.
San Francisco?
There we go. I actually heard it. San Francisco. I think it was Heather.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. Huh. It wasn't going to be Clausen.
Yep. Adjusted for households, it said it's number one. Not only did San Francisco come out as number one with the most restaurants per capita, no other city was even in their league. They have 39.3 restaurants for every 10,000 households. San Francisco has nearly 50% more relative restaurants than the second place, which is Fairfield County, Connecticut. New York City doesn't even chart until number four.
Man, we're talking food again?
I know. Sorry. I'm trying to go as quickly as possible to the next question. What was the original name for the United States of America before Congress renamed it on the 9th of September, 1776?
Not Britain.
Yeah. Britain Light.
Something with Confederation in it?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't say that. It
the West UK.
At Articles of Confederation, so that would have made sense.
Yeah, it was,
says there was a resolution by Richard Henry Lee presented to Congress on June 7th and approved July 2nd, 1776, and basically became official on September 9th. We are not going to be, I mean, this much I can give you, we won't be the blank of America anymore. We will be the United States of America.
Kingdom?
Colonies?
Think too hard. Yeah, Dave got it. It's the United Colonies of America was the first name of our country. And that makes sense.
Yeah, like Vespucci Land or something like that. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So it makes sense.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
What city, what U.S. city was named for a British prime minister?
Pittsville?
Yeah.
William Pitt.
A combination Pittsburgh? Of Beth and Jim. It's Pittsburgh, named after Pitt the Elder. Yes. Okay. Can't let it slip by. It's one of my favorite Simpsons bits of all time. The drunks are in the bar arguing over who the greatest British prime minister. The one guy's yelling Lord Palmerston. The other guy's yelling Pitt the Elder. I'm sorry. It's just classic sort of stuff. Yeah.
So, classic bar talk.
Pittsburgh was named in 1758 by General John Forbes in honor of William Pitt. Formerly, by the way, because we know there is a small, relatively small Catholic university there, Duquesne. Pittsburgh's original name was Fort Duquesne when it started. The earliest known reference to the new name of the settlement is in a letter from Forbes to Pitt the Elder, dated 17 November 1758, notifying Pitt had given his name to the place. And it was also originally referred to as Pittsboro instead of Pittsburgh.
We have a faculty member who got his doctorate at Duquesne.
That's right. What is the longest living mammal on Earth?
It's got to be a whale.
It is a whale, so we're already at partial credit. Do you know what kind of whale?
Blue whale?
Beluga.
No.
Sperm whale?
Nope.
Great white.
Finback? Whale. Humpback? Minke whale? Dolphin?
What is
other kind of whales?
Wonderful, wonderful little bit of historic knowledge, and I cannot wait to bestow it on wife and family when I get home. So they're called bowhead whales.
Bowhead
whales.
Got
that name.
Gotcha.
Very specifically. Some bowhead whales in the modern era have been found with the tips of ivory spears in their flesh. And when they were carbon dated, the spear tips were over 200 years old. Ooh. From ancient whalers. The oldest currently living bowhead whale is at least 211 years old. That's incredible.
Probably still gets AARP cards sent to them all the time. So,
and when they pulled the tip of the spear out, there were words on it that said, "We've been trying to reach you about your car's extender." you all know we're building a house, and that was the suggestion from my 13-year-old son. Can we just get a Sharpie and write on the floor, "We've been trying to reach you about your car's extended warranty"? So like 100 years from now, when someone takes the house over, that's what they find. I'm like, you know.
Just... Now is the time to start graffitiing up inside the walls, Matt. So, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, this is a good one. The song America the Beautiful was inspired by a trip to what very famous American landmark?
Dollywood. Oh.
Yellowstone?
Wasn't Grand Canyon, wasn't Dollywood. Wasn't Yellowstone.
Rushmore? Mount Rushmore?
No, but I'll tell you what, it was a mountain, Heather.
Oh.
Mount Washington. Mount
Rainier.
Mount Clemens.
McKinley.
Mount St. Helen.
Pikes Peak.
Pikes Peak. Pikes Peak, oh, yes. Okay. It's the highest summit on the southern front range of the Rocky Mountains. Named in honor of Zebulon Pike, who was unable to reach the summit, by the way. And in July 1893, Catherine Lee Bates saw Pikes Peak, and having admired the view from the top, wrote the words as a poem that she called Pikes Peak.
Oh.
Yep. First published July 4th, 1895 in a church periodical. I love it. I love it. The plaque commemorating the words to the song are also on the summit. That's kind of cool.
And how many other Zebulons do we know?
Oh my gosh. Zebulon is such a cool name. Like, I couldn't even wait to say it.
I have a Zebulon in my past.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, ancestor.
Oh.
Ooh, this is another fun one. I feel like we've had this one before, but it's always good to do a quick update. Throughout most of history, the Academy Award Oscar statuette has been crafted out of a cheap alloy and plated with 24 karat gold. But for a 3-year timetable during World War II, Oscars were made of no metal at all, but rather
wood or plaster.
It was plaster. Yeah, they were painted plaster for 3 years. Mm-hmm. For the record, following the war, thank you so much, Kimberly. This is so great. Oscar winners could swap their plaster statuettes for the gold-plated versions. Yes. Let's see. Since 2016, Oscars, about 40 of them cast every year by a foundry in the Hudson Valley, have been made of gold-plated bronze. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences gave out the first statuette in 1929. Back then, it was referred to only as the Academy Award of Merit. I think we know the story that one of the helpers said, "That kind of looks like my Uncle Oscar." And boy, oh boy, has a nickname ever caught on faster. What is the only planet that is not named after, be careful, a Roman god or goddess?
Earth?
It's Earth.
Earth,
yeah. Earth, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For example, Saturn is named after the god of agriculture. Venus was the god of love. Neptune, of course, was the god of the sea, etc. Mm-hmm. But Earth is a different etymology.
And Romulus and Vulcan and all those others.
Right, exactly.
Although, as they call it in Lilo and Stitch, Earth.
So what
that's a great movie.
What is Uranus? Is that the god of...
He was the grandfather of the universe. That's sort of the co-etymology there. Yeah, he was like, if Jupiter is Zeus, right? He was like Zeus's dad.
Oh, okay. Wow. Mm-hmm. And was Pluto his dog?
Absolutely.
Okay, just checking. Okay, thanks.
For two different sets of Greek gods.
That wasn't on the dog list.
Yeah, true. Well, there's also two sets of dogs. What's the difference between Pluto and Goofy? I mean... Mm-hmm.
This is kind of interesting. Oh, my. Two numbers here. How many moons does Saturn have discovered as of 2020?
Ooh.
And how many of them have been named? They are not the same number.
Say 12, 15? No, I think there's a lot more. It's like 47 or something like that.
Maybe I'm thinking really of Saturn.
I thought Jupiter had the most. Yeah, that's what 19. I thought too.
One of my favorite bits of trivia when I was growing up, we knew... Because there are certain planetoids as part of the rings that are big enough to essentially qualify as moons.
Oh,
that Saturn always has had the greatest number of moons. It's just a matter of how many we plan to name. As of right now, there are 62 planetoids that are moons, and only 53 have been named, including such fantastic names as Albiorix, Farbaudi, Fenrir, that one's close to my heart right there. Narvi, Skadi, of course, Titan, and Ymir.
Who's getting to name these?
It's gonna be like naming stadiums. Well, that's all.
I said 60. I'm claiming credit for this one.
Yeah, you get it. You get it for sure. Didn't tell you that one of them is named Helene, brought to you by SoFi Insurance. Right, exactly.
Maybe we can name one for us. We could name an ATP.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That sounds like a great idea. How long is the gestation period for a dog?
3 months.
4 months.
6 weeks.
There's only been one of you that's even slightly close. I'm giving it to Heather. It says here it's 9 weeks.
Whoa.
And what's interesting about the range of the different, breeds of dogs is that the absolute error bars are only 56 to 66 days, no matter how large the dog is. It's very discreet. Pretty interesting.
I was listening to the very end of a radio lab today, and they're talking about an octopus that has a 4-year gestational period.
Man, I don't even know what the morning sickness must be like for that poor thing.
Yeesh.
What does a pregnant octopus crave?
Pickles and ice cream?
Let's see here.
Comfort food, pasta. Sorry. Let's, had to go
again,
down that
get
route.
Get away from the food.
Sorry.
What major league pitcher won the most Cy Youngs?
Nolan Ryan.
Cal Ripken Jr.
Mm-mm. Pedro Martinez.
The reliever, New York Yankees.
Rivera?
Mariano? Yeah. No, it doesn't say that. This person has won 7. I can run the rest of the list to sort of, fill it out. Next in line is Randy Johnson with 5. Let's see.
I remember when he played for the Mariners for a while.
There's been several people who've won 2. And in 55 years, only 16 pitchers have won it basically more than once. I mean, that's kind of a big deal. No, it says here, I sigh for those baseball fans. It says Roger Clemens. Yeah.
He had Roger Clemens. I didn't think it was him.
I'm embarrassed.
Me too. He won 5?
He won 7, Stephen. 7.
Wow.
Where basically the average is 1, depending on the way you look at it, right? So
your turn, Stephen.
It's the award given to the best pitcher of the year for both the American League and or the National League. Just a couple more questions here before we're going to have to say goodbye. What was the name of the ship that took Charles Darwin on his voyage to the Galapagos?
HMS Beagle.
Beagle.
Beagle. Absolutely.
The platonic form of a dog.
Mm-hmm.
In my humble opinion.
It more may, if it question. Hadn't been for his work, it may not have been remembered at all. That is absolutely right.
More doggy questions.
You want more dog questions?
Oh, dear Lord.
Well, we just had one. Beagle.
We did. We did. Absolutely.
Our show's going to the dogs.
Last, but certainly not least for today, which country was it that produced the first adhesive postage stamp in 1840?
Britain.
It was actually Britain. It was the UK.
Yeah.
Kind of a big deal. Of course, not just for postage, right? The original plan was to do things by way of taxation and demarcation, things like that.
So what did they do before postage stamps? Was it?
It's a good question. It's a very good question. Yeah.
They were still in their empire days, you know, so kind of makes sense that they would have been first in that area.
So would it just been like wax stamps or something like that? Or just
you paid and they just stamped it at the post office?
According to historical record, Kimberly tells us, prior to 1839, the average number of letters sent was 76 million in the British Empire.
Ooh.
By the time you hit 1850, and you basically made the post accessible to everyone for pennies on the dollar, pennies on the pound, over 350 million letters were circulating 10 years later.
Our postal service has actually always been hugely popular with the public.
Yeah,
it's true.
Until we decided to appoint that idiot, the head of it, DeJoy, and he made them fund their pension 75 years out, which happened quite a while ago, which is why the post office has been struggling so much. But it's in the freaking Constitution.
No, seriously.
We're going to have one.
Yeah. It's one of those oddities of our government that we have this unbelievably important thing. And then the latest headline is, you know, one more day of the week is going to get dropped. You know, it's going to take you even longer. And we all have that story from last year where my parents in Berkeley mailed a Christmas card to my in-laws in Royal Oak, 0.41 miles away, and it did not arrive until February 15th.
Oh, my.
And stuff like that is all over the place right now.
Well, at least that was just a Christmas card. I mean, I can't even imagine the people's medicine and...
Oh, yeah. I'm showing my privilege. I just think that it's incredible. It's like it literally would have taken less overall energy and time
to walk it over.
Across Woodward.
I mean, like right now, I mean, you know, not mean to claim like first world issues, but I've got a weed whacker. We order replacement parts. It's not going to get here till middle of November.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, don't order furniture. It will scare the pants off of you. Things are backed up over 2 years right now.
It's furniture?
Incredible. Professors, the time has come for us to say goodbye, Dave.
See ya.
Jim.
Goodbye.
Heather.
Bye-bye.
Stephen.
Bye. Have a good weekend.
Beth.
Goodbye.
Mara.
See ya.
Dan.
Goodbye.
And now these words...
You can email Ask the Professor at atp@udmercy.edu or visit the Ask the Professor Facebook page.
Ask the Professor is produced and directed by Michael Jason and Brian Masonville, and our executive producer is Professor Jason Roach. Until next week, I'm your host, Matt Mayo.